by Jane Royce.
The Lebanese capital, Beirut, has been hit with one of the largest waves of Israeli bombing so far, as it continues to target the armed group Hezbollah. There were more than 30 airstrikes in the southern suburbs. Israel has issued a new call for residents to evacuate the area. Lebanon's health ministry says 23 people were killed in Israeli strikes across the country yesterday. The Cabinet Minister Peter Kyle says the government will arrange more flights home from Beirut if needed, as the conflict shows no signs of slowing down. The last chartered flight taking British nationals out of Lebanon is expected to arrive back in the UK today. The Foreign Office says more than 250 people have so far fled the country on three previous flights. Authorities in Bosnia-Herzegovina say 18 people are confirmed to have died after floods triggered landslides in the southwest of the country. A huge rescue operation is underway in the city of Jablanica, as more than a dozen people are unaccounted for. Emergency workers are using search dogs to try to locate them under debris. Local elections, due to take place in some of the worst affected areas, have been postponed. The city government in the South Korean capital, Seoul, is to adjust conditions for Filipino nannies taking part in a pilot work program after a series of problems. It was hoped bringing more caregivers to the city could help boost the country's dwindling birth rate, which is one of the lowest in the world. Changes include the scrapping of a nighttime curfew. The nannies will also be able to receive salary payments twice a month. A British climber who went missing in the Himalayas 3 days ago has been rescued. Faye Manners and her climbing partner were ascending Shakamba Mountain in northern India when their food, tent and climbing equipment fell down a steep ravine. The pair sent an emergency message at more than 20,000 feet. The Archbishop of Canterbury is being challenged to support rewilding across the Church of England's estate. Chris Packham will unveil a scroll on the steps of St Paul's Cathedral later today, calling on the church to rewild 30% of the 105,000 acres it owns within 6 years. And the weather: after a cloudy start with some patchy showers, a band of rain will push in from the west of England and Scotland throughout the day, and it will be heavy at times, reaching eastern areas later. BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Good afternoon from me, Chris Barrow. Now it's Private Passions.
The costume designer Jenny Bevan has won three Academy Awards for three very different films: the elegant Merchant Ivory drama Room with a View, the post-apocalyptic Mad Max Fury Road, and most recently the Disney film Cruella, for which she created a huge and vibrant parade of 1970s-inspired fashion. She's received a further 9 Oscar nominations across her 40-year career. She found just the right top hat for Colin Firth in The King's Speech and ditched the deerstalker in favour of a bowler hat for Robert Downey Jr. in Sherlock Holmes. And despite claiming she's never been interested in fashion, she recreated stunning Dior outfits for Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. Well, you brought us a glittering array of musical clothes today, Jenny, including Handel, Beethoven, Mendelssohn. But I think we're going to start with Bach.
We are. Bach is absolutely central to my soul. I think I turn to Bach more often than any of the others in times of distress or joy or whatever. And the two passions are something I knew from a very, very early time, because my father was a cellist and played with the Jakes Orchestra, you know, terribly badly paid musicians in those days. So I often went to rehearsals from a very young age. And my memory is sitting with my legs dangling off a bentwood chair in a rehearsal room. But even then, there were bits I just loved. And of course, my father played the solo in Mein teurer Heiland. Although, of course, what I love about Bach is it was a job. He had to produce something every week to earn his keep wherever he was. So there isn't a sort of mystique about it. I mean, he was just blooming brilliant. But I chose this because of my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Precious Saviour, from Bach's St. John Passion, performed by Sebastian Noack, and Collegium Vocale Ghent, conducted by Philippe Herrevega. A rather beautiful recording, I think.
I love that one. I love anything from Philippe Herrevega. He makes, I think it's because the way he does it sounds like I remember the Jakes Orchestra doing it. And it's very simple. I think he doesn't embellish. It's just pure.
From what you're saying, your dad playing with the Jakes Orchestra, presumably music was quite important to both your parents and your early childhood.
Oh, totally. I'm not quite sure how they met. And of course, they're well past now. But my mother was a child prodigy on the viola and went to the Royal College of Music and was talking in letters about playing late Beethoven quartets when she was 14. And my father, also obviously very good, went to the Royal Academy of Music when he was 16. And the family moved from Wales up to London. And my grandmother a very good pianist, played piano for silent cinema, got the biggest house she could find in Kensal Rise, despite the family saying, just get a small flat, you know, and filled it with artists and musicians. And that became a hub of music. And then at home, I mean, we only had an old, I think it was called a Decalion gramophone, terribly elderly radio. But I mean, we're talking about the 50s, so... But there was a lot of chamber music, quartets were played regularly, and a lot of going to concerts. And my mother stayed playing until my sister was born. And then for some reason she gave up, and I know it was a major mistake. She should have kept playing. We should have had nannies. I mean, I had to keep working when my daughter was born. And I just think she was too good to
stop.
So
it was quite an unconventional upbringing in some ways.
Oh, phenomenally. Both of them were radical, left-wing... alternative, let's say. I mean, we ate nut rissoles from the health shop and ran around barefoot and went to verbal schools and never had television. We drew and we made things all the time. I mean, it was just a lovely, not a lot of money, but just a fun, creative childhood.
Rather than concentrating on an instrument, you were making things, weren't you?
Yeah, much more. I loved music and I really enjoyed playing the cello for a bit, but the idea of practicing never ever appealed. I'm lazy. I just want to be able to do it. And then I had to get piano. And the flute I was probably better on in a way. But actually, theatre had crept into my life through my grandfather, the wild Welsh poet, husband of this fabulous grandmother. He took me to my first Shakespeare. And actually, that was it.
So you did have some musical training. And was your father creative in a broader sense?
Very much so. His absolute love was letterpress printing. And he had a tiny Adana hand press machine at the back of our flat in Kensington. And he also loved photography. And he wrote books, little short books, because obviously it's a very slow process. And he printed them. And then he would do wonderful photographs. Always our Christmas card was a photograph he'd taken. And I just remember he had a whole little enlarging setup with trays of acid and all that. And the smell of the acid and watching the image come up was unbelievably exciting.
Now, the theatrical has crept in already to your list because we're going to hear Benjamin Britten next.
I love Britten and I love Peter Grimes. Wayne Turner the Screw. No, Peter Grimes. Anyway, I chose Peter Grimes and The Storm. I have a brother-in-law, Tim Albury, who's a very fine opera director, and he did a wonderful production on the beach at Aldborough. The music, I just think, particularly the four sea interludes, are just very powerful, and The Storm is simply my favourite, so that's why I thought I'd share
that. It grabs you by the guts, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely, and the way he evokes a storm coming up at sea.
Thank you.
mean, it's just fantastic that. Secretly, I am harbouring ambitions at even this late stage to become a conductor, and I have just been given a conducting baton by my last director, who it's probably one of the most wonderful presents I've ever had. I'm pretty sure that if I actually did conduct, I'd just doing it in my hands. But
what you need now is to be given an orchestra.
That would be helpful. Oh, I'm sure I can find one. But I do an awful lot of conducting in the car, accidentally taking both hands off the wheel. The idea of just pulling that music out is so exciting.
I think the other thing that is extraordinary about it is the way he marries the extremely turbulent to the extremely lyrical and makes them interchange.
Yeah, just like a storm can be. And then it has a bit of a resurging at the end. Just an extraordinary piece for me.
The Storm from Act One of Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes, performed by the Orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by Benjamin Britten. Jenny Bevan, how did you get on with school when you were young?
Ah, fine for a bit. And then I'm a rebel. So I guess I was about 16 and Morley College were doing a stage management course, which one was allowed to do from 16. So I used to go to that, and through that I got to know people in small, semi-professional upper groups. And, you know, I could do anything, make the coffee, paint the scenery, do whatever. So I used to skip off school all the time. Those days it was easier. I would not advise anyone to do it now, but I used to ring up someone and say, could you put my name on the register? And then pray there wouldn't be a fire drill.
I imagine at the age of 14 to lose your mum, Morley Panther, from breast cancer, must have been a pretty devastating, traumatic, especially at that age.
Yeah. I think it was worse for my sister, who was younger. She was ill for quite a long time, and you do get used to things. And I have a slightly, I don't know, cold attitude. It's so inevitable we will die. I'm now really sorry she hasn't seen what I've done, and in fact what my sister, who's a brilliant graphic designer and animal activist. But at the time, I don't know, I just sort of sailed through it. And
were you able to compartmentalise it, perhaps, in some
I
way?
I think I probably was. It's funny, I mean, I've thought about it a bit more recently, but I didn't find it traumatic, and I don't think I've ever had a post-traumatic effect of it. But this fantastic aunt, Poll, who is distant relation, not my actual aunt, with two children, came to look after us. And she was a very good pianist and also within the Halle, and so again the music thing. And we simply joined as a bigger family. So Rod and Claire became like my brother and sister. And he's a fantastic woodblock printer and she's an amazing osteopath now. And we are like one family. And so every so often we get together and massacre hapless Baroque composers. I mean, there was a sort of enrichment through that.
A busy house, then?
Oh, God, it was really busy. Yes, it certainly was busy.
And do you still like a busy house to this
I have
day?
A very busy house. I ran a sort of upmarket student encampment for the poor and needy of the parish.
Now, Schubert next, this wonderful song, Erl König. What attracts you to this in particular? Again, drama again, of course.
Drama, absolutely. In the evenings, we didn't have television, and we used to listen to a huge variety of LPs, from Schubert to Flanders and Swan to Beyond the Fringe. And I did learn German at school. I was much better in German than French. So I sort of learnt this in a curious way. I also, by listening to Schubert, I could quote reams of German, not always knowing what on earth I was talking about. But this song particularly, and I love Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau and Gerald Moore version of it. Yeah, I could listen to it over and over because I was a bit of one of those who, once I found something, I'd put it on repeat, basically.
Just tell us briefly the story, because it's really rather shattering.
It's shattering. The father is riding back through the forest holding his little son, and the son says, "Father, father, can you see the Erl King?" And the father says, "No, no, no, it's just a streak of mist." And then the Erl King speaks to the boy. And, of course, Fischer-Dieskau's doing all the voices. And the father suddenly does realise there's something there, but when he gets home, the boy is dead.
Gute Nacht, gute Wind.
Amazing.
I was thinking that there's quite a close connection with Britain there because, of course, he adored Schubert. And there is in the drama of the horse's hooves there and those repeated triplets, the same kind of turbulence as we heard in The Storm.
That's interesting. I'd never thought of that before. But yes, they do relate.
Erl König, written by Schubert, performed inimically by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau and the pianist Gerald Moore. So, Jenny Bevan, let's go back to your first experiences of theatre and what it said to you and how it influenced your future life.
As I said, we weren't very well off, so I didn't go a huge amount. I remember being taken to the Nutcracker at the Festival Hall by a wonderful aunt, then sort of setting up a little theatre in the corner and making my petticoat into a, you know, all that. But the first real experience of theatre was my grandfather, Arthur Rathke, a Welsh poet of note, who loved Shakespeare and would give us sixpence if we could tell him where a quote came from, which is a lot of money in those days, so we got jolly good at it, decided he wanted to take me to my very first Shakespeare production. And Dorothy Tootin was in Twelfth Night, and I went, I'm probably 10 or 11. I simply fell in love. The spectacle, I loved the idea of a girl playing a boy. I thought that was wildly romantic. And absolutely loved the story and just knew somewhere in my soul that's what I wanted to do. And later on, when I was at school, you could get standing in the gods at what was the National Theatre when it was at the Old Vic for 2 shillings. And it was 2 and 3 pence from Putney to Waterloo return. So I used to skip off, particularly on a Thursday afternoon when there was nothing much happening as far as I was concerned, and go and see a matinee, including, of course, Peter Brook's Oedipus, for which I skipped an art A level, but I still sort of scraped to pass, which was just one of the most extraordinary productions ever.
You went to the Central School of Design, later St Martin's, of course, to study set and costume design.
With Ralph Koltai, who was absolutely at the peak, I think, peak of his career. Very sculptural. He did The Ring for ENO, which was a phenomenal production. He'd take us, all the students, to the general rehearsals of everything he did. So we got an amazing insight into his work, and I absolutely loved that way of working. But I remember him saying to me, darling, you're quite good at set design. You don't worry about the costume. You always get someone else to do them, because he really wasn't that interested.
What do you recall of your early designs?
Well, our very first tutor taught us to see the narrative line in a script or a play. And that stayed with me. And I think I do the same with costume now. You need to see the arc of someone's progress through the clothes they're wearing.
You were only 21 when you came to do Carmen at the Royal Opera House.
Yes, I was only 21. It was an extraordinary story. I was at the Welsh Theatre Company as an Arts Council trainee designer on £17.50 a week, with Michael Jelliot running that and Welsh National Opera. And he was doing Carmen at Covent Garden with Ralph Koltai designing, and Sir Georg Scholte was making his return to the Garden, having been musical director. And Scholte wanted a very realistic Carmen. Ralph obviously was going to a wonderful sculpture, White Wall, which would have looked amazing. But anyway, they came to a decision that Ralph would not do it. And there they were with Placido Domingo, Shirley Verrett, Jose Van Damme. I mean, you know, the works. Yes. Kyrie Kanawa, and no designer. And Michael said to me, did I know Carmen? And I said, well, I know it, but not that well. So he gave me an LP and said, listen to it, and what would you come up with for Act One? So I did a model for Act One. I assumed as a trainee that this was part of, he had to make me do projects. And he looked at this and he said, have you got a passport? Which I thought was a curious thing. And I said, yes. He said, right, we're on a plane tomorrow morning to Frankfurt to see Sir Georg Scholte. So off we went, clutching this model, met in the hotel in Frankfurt. And he liked what I'd done, and it was realistic. But he would like to know what I did for Act Two, the Lilas Pastia scene. So I thought, OK. And then he accepted it. And then he wanted Act Three to Four to be done with a 3.5-minute musical interlude. You're going from the rock scene up on the mountains to the bullring. Thank God for Bill Bundy and the lot at the Royal Opera House, because they were so supportive. And of course, nobody wanted to do the costumes with a 21-year-old designer.
Well, there were about 400.
About 400, yes. Again, incredibly supportive. I mean, everybody hauled me through.
Well, it's actually a musical we're turning to next.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have Losing My Mind from Follies, which I saw. I mean, I just knocked me sideways. I know Imelda, and I've worked with her. Her voice is absolutely amazing. And the way she does it, loads of people do it brilliantly, but for me, it's the best. And seeing her do it live, blooming great.
The sun comes up, I think about you. The coffee cup, I think about you. I want you so, it's like I'm losing my mind. The morning ends, I think about you. I talk to friends, I think about you. And do they know, it's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon doing every little chore, the thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor, not going left, not going. I dim the lights and think about you. Spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved me, or were you just being kind? Or am I losing? Like I'm losing my mind. does no one know? It's like I'm losing my mind. All afternoon doing every little chore. The thought of you stays bright. Sometimes I stand in the middle of the floor. Not going left, not going right. I dim the lights and think about you. Spend sleepless nights to think about you. You said you loved me. Or were you just being kind?
Imagine why I like that so much, because it always evokes the most terribly sad memories of when one has been there, you know. And obviously you just put it away because you just move on and whatever, but it's like hits you.
I was getting quite worried across the studio as I saw you melting.
Yes, well, quite right too.
Losing My Mind, but certainly not my voice, from the musical Follies, written by Stephen Sondheim, performed there by Imelda Staunton, conducted by Nigel Lilly. You worked as a set designer, Jenny Bevan, throughout the 70s, but how did you become involved with Merchant Ivory?
I had a friend called Nick Young who commissioned a film called Hullabaloo over Georgie and Bonnie's Pictures about a group of supposedly art dealers, but basically thieves, descending on a Maharaja's palace in Rajasthan, as he had an apparently legendary collection of miniature paintings. Actually, all of them had the intention of stealing it. They were rogues. But the English art dealer who travelled overland was Dame Peggy Ashcroft. So Nick rang me and said, would I be able to go up to her house and put together a wardrobe of clothes for her to take to India for this character? No money was involved. So it was her wardrobe and mine and anything I could lay hands on. You know, we got on really well. And the second visit, she said to me, my dear, she said, I'm a little worried about going to India on my own. I'm 70. They've given me a first class ticket. If I change it for two economies, will you come with me? And then, of course, I pitch up in Jodhpur, Rajasthan with her. And they immediately get me doing anything. You know, I was crowd collecting, I was doing props, whatever they needed, basically, and looking after Dame Peggy and her wig and her costumes. And then Jennifer Kendall was supposed to come up and play the Scottish governess. She couldn't. I think she was ill or something. And Jim just said, Jenny, you'll be the governess. And it was like, and I was coached by Dame Peggy Ashcroft to read a poem and play Blind Man's Buff with small children on my knee. Not my norm, but anyway.
Now, you became friends with the costume designer John Bright. What did you learn from him?
Everything. John is absolutely the rock of my life. So John owns and ran Cosprop, the best costume house in the world. Don't mind who I say that to. And he is the person who probably taught me the most about film, costume and period costume.
We don't want to take out all the romance of your job, but at that point there would be quite a lot of washing and mending through the night, wouldn't there?
A vast deal. We only ever had sort of one shirt per person. We never did doubles like we do now. So we were forever washing them at night in our hotel sinks and praying it would dry. And I mean, we were so few of us in those days. And we did everything. We dressed, we undressed, we mended, we washed. And now you'd have a team of 15, probably.
Tell me about Room with a View.
Well, that was the first one I did with John. And Ismar Merchant gave us the Alinari photographs of Florence at that time, sort of 1908, and some tourist pamphlets about Florence, which were actually extremely useful for understanding the colours of the buildings. That was all we had. And Jim, the director, he just believed what we were doing, and he said it in interviews since. Well, he says, I just chose people I believed in and let them get on with it. And you can see it to a certain extent, but it was blooming hard work. I was also pregnant, and I was dressing and undressing an enormous amount of Italian crowd who all thought they looked brutte because they were in black. Brutte, Jenny, brutte. And I always forgot to make them do their own bootlaces up before I did the corsets. So I ended up doing the bootlaces and the corsets. I was exhausted, but happy as a clam, really.
But there had to be versatility. The costume you designed for Helena Bonham Carter might have had corsets, but she had to run around playing tennis.
Oh, if you wear... I mean, a corset shouldn't be uncomfortable. I mean, basically, it supports the bust and...
Yes, I've not worn one, so
have
I
have you
can't.
Not, really? Oh, my God. I have. I was an extra in many of Jim's films, and I've done it, which is really interesting. I think every costume designer should put on a costume and be made to do some action and realise it's not that easy. But Helena, she's got a great body for it. And by the time she was playing tennis, she'd been wearing that corset for 6 weeks, so it had moulded to her body. And women in those days would have felt naked without them.
Romantic music next. Well, I say romantic, it's sort of tragic as well.
Mm. Elgar. I do love Elgar. And I love Shaker Kana Mason. I love this piece, which I first heard with Jacqueline Dupre. But I actually love this version of it particularly. I think he's an astonishing player. I love the idea of that whole family being so musical. It's just heaven. And they just love doing it. They all seem to take enormous joy in it. So they're a great inspiration, I think, to everybody.
Thank you. The final part of the Cello Concerto in E Minor by Edward Elgar, performed by Sheku Kane Mason and the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. Does your exposure to music earlier on mean, Jenny Bevan, that hearing something like that is doubly powerful when you hear it in the flesh, particularly in that piece, the bow hitting the string?
Absolutely. I don't go to concerts nearly as much as I would like to, partly because the job I do is ridiculously long hours. And in truth, I do get tired, which really irritates me. But if I possibly can, I do go to concerts still and hear it live.
When you're sent a script for a film, do you draw your designs?
Absolutely not. Drawing is two-dimensional and brings nothing of the body language of the actor. So I do it on 3D stands. I mean, put them on a stand, get the look, photograph them, show the director, and then if necessary, put them on a real person. It's not the same as the real actor, but you get a sense of where it's going to go. But I do a lot of mood boards, so finding images that might work, you know. So it's a build-up of visual ideas to show a director, but the actual work is done on the actor in the fitting.
But I suppose one of the difficulties is knowing who the actor will be, because
yes.
You do know who they'd like it to be,
yes.
But it doesn't always follow, does
no,
it?
No, and they often, you know, you get Vanessa Redgrave, 5'11", and then suddenly she can't do it, or vice versa, if it was Imelda to Vanessa or something. So you just have to work fast and adapt.
Do you get a lot of time to prepare, or is it not as quick a turnaround as music, which is always the very last thing?
Well, sometimes it's really quick. I mean, Cruella, for instance, we had 10 weeks. Literally, they had this window of opportunity in Emma Stone's schedule, and the person who was going to do it felt it just wasn't enough time. She was so right. I'm quite good at that, and I think being a little older, not too old, obviously, helps you just know how to approach the problem. I'm always lastminute.com, rescue missions, Bevan.
Do you have favourites amongst the period dramas you've done?
I mean, I have a tremendous fondness for anything I did with James Ivory, and I think Remains of the Day is probably... I think it's the most complete film. From a costume point of view, it's the least showy, but the whole and the emotions in it, and Emma Thompson and Tony Hopkins just... I think it's my sort of slight zenith, really.
Well, that and Howard's End were pretty wonderful to look at.
Pretty amazing.
Handel next.
I love Handel. I just heard it by chance on YouTube. And I love a countertenor because I love the purity of the voice and I absolutely love a trumpet. So it's rather a good combination.
Thank you.
I love the way Yestyn Davies and Alison Balsam blend their voices
there.
I mean,
absolutely divine is the word, isn't it? They're just extraordinary together.
Eternal Source of Light Divine by George Frederick Handel, performed by Yestyn Davies and Alison Balsam, playing the trumpet, and the English concert conducted by Trevor Pinnock. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the Oscar-winning costume designer, Jenny Bevan. Jenny, you had a relationship with the theatre producer and manager Ian Albury and a daughter called Caitlin. How difficult was it balancing being a mum with the enormous demands of filmmaking?
Not easy, but happily, when Caitlin was about 8 months old, I got my first job after, and it was Morris, again, Merchant Ivory. And I found, by sheer luck, the most phenomenal nanny, Suzanne, who became Do, because Caitlin couldn't say S's, so Sue became Do. And she became the rock of the family, and that made my life possible. But I was a blooming awful mother, to be honest. And it was only much more latterly when I actually was able to be the mother for my daughter, who had a tragedy with her first husband. He died, and I could actually be there and be... It was all during COVID, so I wasn't working, and be the mum I never was.
Well, talking of families, I sort of sense that every time you get involved with a film, it's like being part of a new family.
Absolutely. The whole thing is quite family, if you're on a good one, and people are team workers, collaborative and all that.
And on the whole, do you find these sort of stars friendly or rather arrogant?
No, on the whole, they're incredibly nice. And when they come with a difficult reputation, it's not necessarily true. And I'm a little bit down to earth. I mean, I'm not going to frighten anyone. I'm not going to tell them they're going to wear this. I'm going to suggest that's what I think might work and then listen to them and do it as a collaboration, which normally works best because they know the part probably better than I do, or they have a different take on how they're going to do it. And I know the clothes.
And do actors get nervous about fittings?
Some do, and some just find it the most wonderful because it's when they find the character. And that's what I'm there to help them do, to support the character, tell the story through the clothes. And so the best moment you can ever imagine is when they look at themselves in the mirror and they say, oh, now I know who I am. And you just think, score.
And do they quite often unload their feelings, their problems on you as somebody they can talk to about what's going on?
I think that can happen because the fitting room is a bit like a confessional. And I have heard a lot of things, but luckily I have an extremely short memory, so they don't have to have any worries about my divulging anything. A, I wouldn't, and B, I've normally forgotten.
Your next piece of music was in The King's Speech. That was a wonderful film, I thought, starring Colin Firth. What were the challenges with that particular production?
Because there's a lot of footage of that time and a lot of photographs, it was a real pressure to get it right, but also appropriate for the actors involved. The tricky bit is that some of the actors don't look like the people, and Colin was terribly worried because he felt... I mean, George VI was tiny, obviously terribly ill with smoking and cancer and very, very thin. And Colin isn't. I mean, he's slim and gorgeous, but he's not emaciated. Mm. And Helena Bonham Carter is probably nearer the Queen Mother, but equally... What was really interesting with her was that the Queen Mother used to wear quite pastel bright colours, but you do that on Helena as the Queen Mum and she looked like she was wearing costume. So we muted everything. We dipped things down or we used muted colours and then she became her.
And the music?
Ah, well, this Seventh Symphony. Again, when we make the film, we're just making the jigsaw pieces. And it's at the cast and crew showing, normally. It's the first time you actually see it together. The music's always a massive surprise. And this was particularly, and I thought, what a genius choice of music, because it just evokes that sort of throbbing, bum, 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 bum. I really enjoyed seeing that film. Very proud of it.
The Allegretto, the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony in A Major, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Kirill Petrenko. Somehow that had such a, as you say, appropriateness in the film, doesn't it?
It does. Extraordinary. And that moment in his life and the war and the We Will Prevail speech, I mean, it's just perfect.
And there's even a kind of slightly stuttering aspect to it.
I thought Colin got that absolutely perfectly.
You won your second Oscar, Jenny Bevan, for the costumes for Mad Max Fury Road. For anyone who's not seen the film, it's a dystopian road movie set in a post-apocalyptic desert wasteland where petrol and water are scarce commodities. How did you start designing on that film?
Well, I got this call from Ian Smith, the producer. You know, was I? He said, I know you're good in deserts and I know you're good far away from home for a long time. And I said, OK, fine. He said, I want you to come to Australia next week. So I went off and met George. I mean, there was no script. We were doing it from a graphic novel. And George was making Happy Feet, all about penguins, and he already had a plan. And he tried to make it for the past 30 years. There was quite a lot of information. Basically, we went and shot it in Namibia, where there's the perfect wasteland landscape, but quite tricky to work in.
In what way, particularly for a costume designer?
Well, yes, availability of stuff. I mean, we bought everything they'd ever had from Road Warrior, the previous Mad Max film. But a lot of it was quite S&M, and I didn't feel that was right for this day and age. So I wanted to give it a much more gutsy feel and more practical. So we were at various places in the sand dunes, in the mountains of that part of Namibia, which is on the coast. Swakopmund was our base.
Sinead O'Connor next.
Ah, the sky in Namibia, there's no peripheral light. You're just looking up to the heavens. And we had this birthday party in the dunes, and we were all sitting round. We had the little tea lights, and Stephen, my wonderful friend who's a great maker and worked with me on loads of films, also has a beautiful tenor voice, sings in his church choir in Bursey, suddenly just started to sing this, and it was like amazing, and I never forgot it, and I loved Sinead O'Connor's version of it. It's just one of those folk songs that hits you again. I think that's what all the music does to me. It sort of hits me.
My own love said to me, my mother won't mind, and my father I got
Imagine that in the still night air of Namibia, in the desert, in the sand, looking up at this unbelievable sky. I mean, it was pretty powerful.
He Moved Through the Fair by Sinead O'Connor. What I loved about her voice there was that mixture of the untrained, unoperatic voice and the folk, and a beautiful quality to the voice, which is just there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit like Imelda, I suppose, although Imelda may well have been trained more, but it's not too refined. It's raw, but incredibly beautiful phrasing and perfectly in tune.
Jenny Bevan, Cruella, the origin story of Cruella de Vil, in 2021 brought you your third Oscar, starring Emma Stone as Estella and Emma Thompson as her rival, the haute couture designer Baroness von Hellman. They had a lot of costume changes, didn't they?
We had a lot of costume. It was a film about costume, let's be honest. They're both fashion designers. Obviously, Emma had this incredible progress from being a child through to making for Glenn Close, basically, in 101 Dalmatians. It was challenging.
She had 47, I think.
Whether we actually see them all, I don't know, but it was a huge number, and I think, I can't remember what the Baroness had, but it was a lot.
How did you go about creating that many extravagant-looking costumes for each of them?
Again, by finding wonderful pieces. I used to do Portobello Friday morning because it's inspirational. Just being out with clothes and all those variety of things you get in that wonderful area. And also just in costume houses, because there is a lot of 70s. My memory, because I'm very much of that era, when I was quite interested in clothes, or more than I am now, and went to Bieber and Bus Stop and all those sort of crocodile. So I kind of knew it.
So how big a team would you have on something like that?
Gosh, it was huge. I think I had 5 different cutters. Jane Lord just did the Baroness because it was such a separate thing. And then I had 4 in the workroom who all had very different skills, 3 other designers. We had a massive team on set, obviously looking after everybody. We had dyers, breaker downers, embellishers, fitters, and we were a huge employer, of course, during that time.
Well, talking of that, after this film was made, you started to raise the question of what costume designers are paid. Is this a big issue in the industry?
Oh, massive. I mean, we are historically some of the worst paid because we're women.
You were very critical of the way in which companies like Disney profit from your ideas.
They do indeed, but I was very much backed up by the Costume Guild of America in this. It wasn't entirely me on my own, but I was critical and I felt it had to be said. It wasn't exactly my ideas they took, but they endorsed a fashion line that was called Cruella and everyone thought it was me. But the work that I saw created by this fashion line, I did not think was very good. The union, the guild in LA, were absolutely furious and really supported me. I wasn't a member of the union or the guild, and I didn't even know this was happening. And suddenly there was this sort of blast. And so I got very involved with them. And then I realised I had a voice and I could help. And there's this whole pay equity now and Naked Without Us, which I think should be inappropriate without us, because I think actors wouldn't go on naked, but they wouldn't necessarily wear as good as we can do. But I certainly have become much more political and strong. And I always try and be very respectful, because that was my point with Disney. It was deeply disrespectful what they did to us, me. But equally, I will say what I think now.
Now, the Plughole Quartet doesn't have quite the same cachet as the Amadeus or the Borodin, but it's very important to you.
Very important, Michael, yes. So Rod's very good on violin. Hill is blooming good on the viola, which he took up rather late in life. I am adequate on the cello and can count like crazy. And Claire plays the flute. And we started because my Aunt Paul asked us to play at her funeral. She didn't say play music, she said play. And so we did music for a while and we got through it. And we called ourselves the Plughole Quartet. And we, as I said, massacre hapless Baroque composers.
It's a wonderful piece by Mendelssohn that you've chosen. It's the famous octet.
It's a famous octet. I just love it.
And which movement have you homed in?
I've chosen the scherzo.
Thank you. The Scherzo from Mendelssohn's Octet for Strings in E-flat, performed by the Nash Ensemble. It makes one smile, that piece, doesn't it?
It does. It's just glorious.
I've often wondered whether you've ever designed a costume you'd love to own, because you have a reputation for turning up to award ceremonies in somewhat interesting outfits.
Michael, I'm short, fat and Welsh. There's no way I'm going to wear a dress. And also, I cannot do heels. And so they've always slightly been what I thought was a homage to my film, i.e. the slight biker look for Mad Max. And of course, it caused a furore. And I'm kind of proud of it. And certainly most women really loved what I did. And quite a lot of men too. I think some were just mildly shocked. But I did it with respect.
Well, I think when Stephen Fry described you at the BAFTAs in 2016, he was saying with great warmth, actually.
I think he was. I love
only
Stephen.
One of the greats of cinematic costume design, he said, would come to an awards ceremony dressed as a bag lady. It created a few headlines.
It certainly did, and I'm sure it got me the Oscar because, you know, there's no publicity like bad publicity. And curiously, I am actually at last writing the book I've meant to do for ages, and one of my titles is Memoirs of Bag Lady. But I am going to check that Stephen doesn't mind because I think it's never been forgotten.
Well, Jenny Bevan, tell us what your final track is.
So my final track is Within You, Without You from the Beatles. As my father is one of the six cellos playing on this, named, and it was my claim to fame when I was younger. My dad being on Within You, Without You and playing with George Harrison is pretty blooming marvellous.
A lovely note to finish on. Thank you very much, Jenny Bevan.
It's a pleasure. Been gorgeous.
To realize it's all.
Within You, Without You, written by George Harrison, performed by the Beatles. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the costume designer Jenny Bevan. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael's guest is the lexicographer Sarah Ogilvie.
Live music lives on BBC Radio 3.
An evening of Rachmaninoff. The London Philharmonic Orchestra, with soloist Leif Uwe Andsnes, performing the epic third piano concerto and the bittersweet choral symphony, The Bells. Join me, Martin Handley, for Radio 3 in Concert, Wednesday night from 7:30.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's 1:30. Now it's over to Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. Each week we meander towards a single piece of music through a landscape of sound, a kind of Venn diagram that places our destination in context. And today we're headed for Granada. This is Recuerdos de la Alhambra, Memories of the Alhambra, a miniature by the Spanish composer and guitarist Francisco Tárrega. Its delightful melody and technical intricacy makes it one of the best-loved pieces in the classical guitar repertoire. And at just 5 minutes long, we'll hear it at the end of the show. The intricacy of the fingerwork is a mirror to the extraordinary detail of the building which inspired it, the Alhambra Palace in the Andalusian city of Granada, and we'll get there later on. But first, to plant us firmly on Spanish soil, here's Emmanuel Chabrier and his orchestral showpiece, España.